Episode 2, The Castle. Jonathan Harker is in Germany, about to enter the final leg of his journey to Transylvania to meet Count Dracula. He tallies his adventures in this strange land in his private journal.
Of May, Bistritz. It was on the dark side of twilight when we got to Bistritz, which is a very interesting old place, being practically on the frontier, for the Borgo Pass leads from it into Bukovina. Count Dracula had directed me to go to the Golden Crone Hotel. I was evidently expected, for when I got near the door, I faced a cheery-looking elderly woman in the usual peasant dress of white undergarment with long double apron, front and back, fitting almost too tight for modesty. When I came close, she bowed and said,
"The Herr Englishman?"
Yes, Jonathan Harker?
I have for you this letter.
Thank you.
Bitte schön.
My friend, welcome to the Carpathians. I am anxiously expecting you. Sleep well tonight. At 3 tomorrow, the diligence will start for Bukovina. A place on it. Is kept for you. At the Borgo Pass, my carriage will await you and will bring you to me. I trust that your journey from London has been a happy one and that you will enjoy your stay in my beautiful land. Your friend, Dracula.
I asked the old man if he knew Count Dracula and could tell me anything of his castle. He and his wife, the old lady who had received me, looked at each other in a frightened sort of way. They crossed themselves vigorously and, saying that they knew nothing at all, simply refused to speak further. It was so near the time of starting that I had no time to ask anyone else. It was all very mysterious and not by any means comforting. Just before I was leaving, the old woman came up to my room. Come in.
Please, may I speak with you?
For a moment.
Must you go to this place? Oh, young Herr, must you go?
But of course. I must go at once. I'm engaged in important business.
Do you know what day it is?
The 4th of May, I believe.
Oh, yes, I know that. But do you know what day it is?
Madam, I do not understand your question.
It is the eve of St. George's Day. Do you not know that tonight, when the clock strikes midnight, all the evil things in the world will have full sway? Do you know where you are going? And what you are going to?
She was in such evident distress that I tried to comfort her, but without effect. Finally, she went down on her knees and implored me not to go, at least to wait a day or two before starting. It was all very ridiculous, but still, I did not feel comfortable. However, there was business to be done, and I could allow nothing to interfere with it. I, therefore, tried to raise her up and said as gravely as I could that I thanked her, but my duty was imperative, and that I must go. She then rose and dried her eyes and, taking a crucifix from her neck, offered it to me.
Take this. It will protect you.
Well, as an English churchman, I have been taught to regard such things as in some measure idolatrous.
Please, for your mother's sake.
With this, she put the rosary round my neck, crossed herself repeatedly, and went out of the room. I'm writing up this part of the diary whilst I'm waiting for the coach. The crucifix is still round my neck. Whether it is the old lady's fear, or the many ghostly traditions of this place, or the crucifix itself, I do not know, but I am not feeling nearly as easy in my mind as usual. If this book should ever reach Mina before I do, let it bring my goodbye. Here comes the coach. Our driver cracked his big whip and we set off on our journey. The road was rugged, but still we seemed to fly over it with a feverish haste. The driver was evidently bent on losing no time in reaching the Borgo Pass. By the roadside were many crosses, and as we swept by, my companions all crossed themselves. When it grew dark, there seemed to be some excitement amongst the passengers, and they kept speaking to the driver, one after the other, as though urging him to further speed. He lashed the horses unmercifully with his long whip and urged them on to further exertions. The mountains seemed to come nearer to us on each side and to frown down upon us. We were entering on the Borgo Pass. One by one, several of the passengers offered me a blessing, the sign of the cross, and the guard against the evil eye. The driver came to a stop, and we stood silently in the blackness of the night. Then the driver leaned forward, and on each side the passengers, craning over the edge of the coach, peered eagerly into the darkness. I was now myself looking out for the conveyance which was to take me to the Count. Each moment I expected to see the glare of lamps through the blackness, but all was dark. The only light was the flickering rays of our own lamps, in which the steam from our hard-driven horses arose in a white cloud. I was already thinking what I had best do, when the driver, looking at his watch, turned to me.
There is no carriage here. The hare is not expected after all. You now come on to Bukovina and return tomorrow, or the next day. Better the next day.
Then, amongst a chorus of cries from the peasants and a universal applause of themselves, a caleche with four horses drove up behind us, overtook us, and drew up beside the coach. I could see from the flash of our lamps as the rays fell on them that the horses were coal black and splendid animals. They were driven by a tall man with long brown beard and a great black hat, which seemed to hide his face from us. I could only see the gleam of a pair of very bright eyes, which seemed red in the lamplight as he turned to us. He said to the driver,
"You are early tonight, my friend. The English hare was in a hurry. That is why, I suppose, you wished him to go on to Bukovina. You cannot deceive me, my friend. I know too much, and my horses are swift."
As he spoke, he smiled, and the lamplight fell on a hard-looking mouth with very red lips and sharp-looking teeth as white as ivory. One of my companions whispered,
"For the dead travel fast."
The strange driver evidently heard the words, for he looked up with a gleaming smile. The passenger turned her face away, at the same time putting out her two fingers and crossing herself.
"Give me the luggage."
With surprising speed, my bags were handed out and put in the caleche. Then I descended from the side of the coach, as the caleche was close alongside, the driver helping me with a hand which caught my arm in a grip of steel. His strength must have been prodigious. Without a word, he took his reins, the horses turned, and we swept into the darkness of the pass. As I looked back, I saw the steam from the horses of the coach by the light of the lamps, and projected against it the figures of my late companions. Then the driver cracked his whip and called to his horses, and off they swept on their way to Bukovina. As they sank into the darkness, I felt a strange chill, and a lonely feeling came over me. But a cloak was thrown over my shoulders and a rug across my knees, and the driver said to me,
"The night is chill, mynheer, and my master the Count bade me take all care of you. There is a flask of Schlivovitz underneath the seat if you should require it."
The carriage went at a hard pace straight along. Then we made a complete turn and went along another straight road. I was curious to know how time was passing, so I struck a match and by its flame looked at my watch. It was within a few minutes of midnight. A dog began to howl somewhere far down the road, a long, agonized wailing as if from fear. The sound was taken up by another dog, and then another, and another, till borne on the wind, which now sighed softly through the pass. Suddenly, away on our left, I saw a faint, flickering blue flame. The driver saw it at the same moment. He at once checked the horses and, jumping to the ground, disappeared into the darkness. I did not know what to do, the less as the howling of the wolves grew closer. During his absence, the horses began to tremble worse than ever. I could not see any cause for it, for the howling of the wolves had ceased altogether, but just then the moon appeared. And by its light, I saw around us a ring of wolves with white teeth and lolling red tongues. Just as I called to the coachman, I heard his voice raised in a tone of imperious command, and, looking towards the sound, saw him stand in the roadway. As he swept his long arms, the wolves fell back. He repeated the gesture, and the wolves fell back further still. Just then, a heavy cloud passed across the face of the moon. We swept on our way, now in almost complete darkness. Suddenly, I became conscious that the driver was pulling up the horses in the courtyard of a vast ruined castle, from whose tall black windows came no ray of light, and whose broken battlements showed a jagged line against the moonlit sky. Just as I descended the calèche, the horses started forward, and, trap and all, disappeared down one of the dark openings. I stood in silence where I was, for I did not know what to do. What sort of place had I come to, and among what kind of people? Just then I saw through the chinks the gleam of a coming light. There was the sound of rattling chains and of massive bolts drawn back. A key was turned with a loud grating noise of long disuse, and the great door swung back. Within stood a tall old man, clean-shaven save for a long white moustache, and clad in black from head to foot, without a single speck of colour about him anywhere.
"Welcome to my house. Enter freely, and of your own will."
He made no motion of stepping to meet me, but stood like a statue, as though his gesture of welcome had fixed him into stone. The instant, however, that I had stepped over the threshold, he moved impulsively forward, and holding out his hand, grasped mine with a strength which made me wince, an effect which was not lessened by the fact that it seemed as cold as ice, more like the hand of a dead than living man.
"Come freely, go safely, and leave something of the happiness you bring."
"Count Dracula."
"I am Dracula, and I bid you welcome, Mr. Harker, to my house. Come in, the night air is chill, and you must need to eat and rest. You are my guest, and it is late. My people are not available. Let me see to your comfort myself.
He led me along a passage, and then up a great winding stair, and along another great passage, on whose stone floor our steps rang heavily. At the end of this, he threw open a heavy door, and I rejoiced to see within a well-lit room, in which a table was spread for supper, and on whose mighty hearth a great fire of logs flamed and flared. By this time I had finished my supper, and by my host's desire had drawn up a chair by the fire. I had now an opportunity of observing him, and found him of a very marked physiognomy. His face was aquiline, with high bridge of the thin nose and peculiarly arched nostrils, with lofty domed forehead and hair growing scantily round the temples. His eyebrows were very massive, almost meeting over the nose, and with bushy hair that seemed to curl in its own profusion. The mouth was fixed and rather cruel-looking, with sharp white teeth. These protruded over the lips, whose remarkable ruddiness showed astonishing vitality in a man of his years. His ears were pale, and at the tops extremely pointed, and the cheeks firm though thin. The general effect was one of extraordinary pallor. His hands had seemed rather white and fine, but seeing them now close, I could not but notice that they were rather coarse, broad, with squat fingers. Strange to say, there were hairs in the center of the palm. The nails were long and fine and cut to a sharp point. As the Count leaned over me and his hands touched me, I could not repress a shudder, for his breath was rank, and a horrible feeling of nausea came over me, which, do what I would, I could not conceal. The Count, evidently noticing it, drew back, and with a grim sort of smile, which showed more of his protuberant teeth, sat himself down again on his own side of the fireplace. We were both silent for a while, and as I looked towards the window, I saw the first dim streak of the coming dawn. The wolves.
Listen to them, the children of the night. What music they make.
My dear Count.
Ah, sir, you dwellers in the city cannot enter into the feelings of the hunter. But you must be tired. Your bedroom is all ready. And tomorrow you shall sleep as late as you will. I have to be away till the afternoon. So sleep well and dream well. I take my leave.
Good night. I am all in a sea of wonders. I doubt, I fear. I think strange things, which I dare not confess to my own soul. God keep me, if only for the sake of those dear to me. I slept till late in the day, and awoke of my own accord. When I had dressed myself, I went into the room where we had supped, and found a card on the table, on which was written,
I have to be absent for a while. Do not wait for me, Dracula.
A cold breakfast had been laid for me, so I set to and enjoyed a hearty meal. By the time I had finished, it was early evening. I looked about for something to read, for I did not like to go about the castle until I had asked the Count's permission. There was absolutely nothing in the room, book, newspaper, or even writing materials, so I opened another door in the room and found a sort of library. In the library I found, to my great delight, a vast number of English books, whole shelves full of them, and bound volumes of magazines and newspapers, all relating to England and English life and customs and manners. Whilst I was looking at the books, the door opened and the Count entered.
Good morning, my young friend, Mr. Harker. I trust you have had a good night's rest.
Why, yes, I did. Thank you.
I am glad you found your way in here, for I am sure there is much that will interest you.
It is indeed an extensive collection.
Through these books, I have come to know your great England, and to know her is to love her. I long to go through the crowded streets of your mighty London, to be in the midst of the whirl and rush of humanity, to share its life, its change, its death, and all that makes it what it is. But alas, as yet I only know your tongue through books. To you, my friend, I look that I know it to speak.
But, Count, you know and speak English thoroughly.
I thank you, my friend, for your all too flattering estimate.
Indeed, you speak excellently.
Not so. I know that did I move and speak in your London, none there are who would not know me for a stranger. That is not enough for me. I have been so long the master that I would be master still. I am sorry that I had to be away so long today, but you will, I know, forgive one who has so many important affairs in hand.
I shall, of course, do as you wish. And may I come into this library from time to time?
Yes, certainly. You may go anywhere you wish in the castle, except where the doors are locked, where, of course, you will not wish to go. There is reason that all things are as they are. And did you see with my eyes and know with my knowledge, you would perhaps better understand.
This led to much conversation, and as it was evident that he wanted to talk, if only for talking's sake, I asked him many questions regarding things that had already happened to me or come within my notice. Sometimes he sheered off the subject or turned the conversation by pretending not to understand, but generally he answered all I asked most frankly. Then, as time went on and I had got somewhat bolder, I asked him of some of the strange things of the preceding night. I say, Count Dracula, last night, why did the coachman go to the places where he had seen the blue flames? Was it indeed true that they showed where gold was hidden?
That treasure has been hidden in the region through which you came last night. There can be but little doubt, for it was the ground fought over for centuries by the Wallachian, the Saxon, and the Turk.
But how can it have remained so long undiscovered when there is a sure index to it if men will but take the trouble to look?
Because the peasant is at heart a coward and a fool. Those flames only appear on one night, and on that night, no man of this land will, if he can help it, stir without his doors. Even the peasant that you tell me of, who marked the place of the flame, would not know where to look in daylight, even for his own work. You would not, I dare be sworn, be able to find these places again.
You are correct in that.
Now come, tell me of London and of the house which you have procured for me.
With an apology for my amissness, I went into my own room to get the papers from my bag. Whilst I was placing them in order, I heard a rattling of china and silver in the next room, and as I passed through, noticed that the table had been cleared and the lamp lit, for it was by this time deep into the dark of the night.
The sun sets and the world becomes alive. But I digress. Come to the business at hand.
Yes. Now then, the estate itself is called Carfax. No doubt a corruption of the old Carta Fache, as the house is four-sided, agreeing with the cardinal points of the compass. It contains in all some 20 acres, quite surrounded by the solid stone wall I've mentioned. The house is very large, and of all periods back, I should say to medieval times, for one part is of stone immensely thick, with only a few windows high up and heavily barred with iron. It looks like part of a keep, and is close to an old chapel or church. I have taken with my Kodak views of it from various points. The house has been added to, but in a very straggling way, and I can only guess at the amount of ground it covers, which must be very great. There are but few houses close at hand, one being a very large house only recently added to and formed into a private lunatic asylum. It is not, however, visible from the grounds.
I am glad that it is old and big. A house cannot be made habitable in a day. And after all, how few days go to make up a century. I rejoice also that there is a chapel of old times. I love the shadows and would be alone with my thoughts when I may.
Presently he left me. He was some little time away, and I began to look at some of the books around me. One was an atlas, which I found open naturally at England, as if that map had been much used. On looking at it, I found in certain places little rings marked, and on examining these, I noticed that one was near London, on the east side, manifestly where his new estate was situated. The other two were Exeter and Whitby on the Yorkshire coast. It was the better part of an hour when the Count returned.
Ah, my friend, you must not work always. Come, I am informed that your supper is ready.
He took my arm, and we went into the next room, where I found an excellent supper ready on the table.
Why, there is the morning again. How remiss I am to let you stay up so long. You must make your conversation regarding my dear new country of England less interesting, so that I may not forget how time flies by us.
With a courtly bow, he quickly left me. I went into my own room and drew the curtains, but there was little to notice. My window opened into the courtyard. All I could see was the warm gray of quickening sky.